B. Collins.
Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Wednesday, November 14th, 2018. There's a lot of bad advice floating out there for Democrats. Some of it's coming from Democrats, including the top leadership. The pundits are telling Democrats to be moderate, be cautious. Don't overreach with the new majority in the House of Representatives. And I think that is the worst advice that you could offer. And I have disagreed with the unifying statements that Nancy Pelosi has been serving up since last week, when it became clear she would become or return to the role of Speaker of the House. She talked about bipartisanship, seeking inroads with Republicans on infrastructure and preserving protections for Americans with pre-existing conditions. And while she talks about oversight and maybe a few subpoenas, we're told that impeachment is not a consideration. And this is leading to a tug of war in the party. Some of the newly elected progressive members and incumbents reelected who are members of the Progressive Caucus want to at least address climate change and try to move some issues that are seen as contentious with the Republican brick wall that they face. But it appears that the Democratic base, according to recent polls, don't agree with this cautious approach. Because we are learning that, let's see what the number here is. Half of Americans say they prefer politicians who stick to their positions, while slightly fewer say they like those who make compromises with people they disagree with, you know, working across the aisle. Now, this is a big shift from July 2017, when 58% of the public said they preferred politicians who compromised, compared with 39% who like people who stick with their positions. So it has flipped, essentially. And here's another stat. Republicans who wanted to see compromise dropped from 46 to 44% between July of 17 and this past March. But Democrats dropped from 69% to 46%. And Mark Pocan, co-chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, said a number of Democratic members prefer to spend their life in the fetal position, rocking in the corner of a room. Good for you, Mark. We don't do that. We're the folks out there trying to advocate for big change. We're going to fight like hell to get those things done, and that's what we're going to expect out of leadership as well. But I believe that the Democrats can walk and chew gum. At the same time, they can fight for pre-existing conditions to be retained, while they also challenge the president and his sycophantic party members on immigration and on government oversight issues, on the EPA, and also, yes, on governance, including the impeachment of this president. Now, just as I speak out of one side of my mouth and say, look, you can't go into a fight like this preaching unity and bipartisanship and expect to get much. But there is a modest prospect that in the lame duck session that will occur between now and the end of the year, that we may see a bipartisan bill to change sentencing laws. Now, it's not a perfect package. None ever is. And it's got some stinky fingerprints on it, those of Crown Prince Jared Kushner. And we believe that his drive for sentencing reform is in part due to the experience that he had when his father spent several years in prison. And I will acknowledge that while I find Jared Kushner, particularly as it relates to Saudi Arabia, the Israeli-Palestinian peace process, to be a guy who is in way over his head. On this, he has worked for many months now with Van Jones, and Van's runs a group was called Cut 50. His co-director is Jessica Sloan, who is a local elected official here in Marin County, and a woman who had a husband. Her ex-husband went to prison on drug charges. and she has dedicated her life to making change. And I respect that they have been going into the belly of the beast and dealing with Jared and Ivanka and other White House staffers. They navigated around Jeff Sessions, and now he's out of the way. He was one of the people who was definitely against this. I think that he's just a cruel man, but also he thinks that it's not good politics for Republicans. So this week, we're told that yesterday, Jared spent the afternoon with his father-in-law, I guess in between glances at the TV screens, and persuaded him to support this. And we're told that Trump was initially lukewarm, but he warmed to it and has described himself as now supporting the package. But as of Wednesday morning, many senators hadn't even seen a draft text of the bill. We know that Dick Durbin has been working with, he's a Democrat, by the way, from Illinois, in case you don't know him, but he's been working with Chuck Grassley, the Republican chair of the Judiciary Committee, and they appear to have reached some points of consensus. Now, Mitch McConnell, the Senate leader, who said that he had agreed to take up the bill if it had at least 60 senators supporting cloture, has now added that given the crunch of the lame duck session, he also has to see how it stacks up against other priorities. So there's no guarantee. But the new package is called the First Step Act. It builds on a prison overhaul bill passed by the House this year, adding changes that would begin to unwind some of the tough-on-crime policies from the 80s and the 1990s. The changes would include shortening mandatory minimum sentences for some nonviolent drug offenses, changing the three-strikes penalty from life to 25 years max. It would also clarify the so-called stacking mechanism, making it a federal crime, for example, to possess a firearm while committing another crime, like a drug offense. And the new law would apply that only to individuals who have been previously convicted. It would also extend retroactively a reduction to the Joe Biden sentencing disparity between crack and powder cocaine. He never gets proper credit for that, and I am dedicated to ensuring that you know that it was Joe Biden who wrote and rammed through the crack cocaine law that created such great disparities and was unaddressed for almost 20 years. So we'll see how this pans out. I am mildly optimistic, but given Trump and how he loves to turn on even his own people when he sees it to his advantage, given his own exposure to criminal offenses and prosecution for them, he might think twice about this. Just bad optics. Meanwhile, Betsy DeVos, who is the billionaire from the Amway fortune who bought her way in as education secretary, she's going to release a sweeping overhaul, and it's very controversial, of the rules for colleges and universities dealing with allegations of sexual assault and sexual harassment. Now, I have to tell you that I'm squeamish about this because I don't trust Betsy DeVos. She is proposing significant changes to the 1972 law called Title IX that bars sex discrimination at schools that receive federal funding. And the Obama administration had used that leverage to pass guidelines related to investigations of sexually related offenses, and DeVos is changing that. Now, I am a longtime defender of the rights of the accused, and one of the moves that she is making is to allow the accused person, typically a male, to defend himself and to face the accuser. Now, that's not a good idea in all cases, but fundamentally, I do want some way for an accused person to properly offer a defense. And I don't think that the setting on a college campus should deny them of their fundamental constitutional rights. But the part that I'm extremely uncomfortable with is that the new DeVos rules would guarantee the accused person the right to cross-examine their accusers. Now, they're saying that it could be done with the people in separate rooms so that a victim would not have to directly face the accuser. Still, the idea of cross-examination, even if it's done through a third party and without a face-to-face exchange, is going to discourage many victims from ever reporting such a crime. And on that basis, I oppose it, and I think that this is a very dangerous process that has been undertaken. While we're on the criminal beat, El Chapo's trial is underway in New York, and the opening statements yesterday led to immediate drama because the defense attorney, who is named Jeffrey Lichtman, appeared to surprise the judge and the prosecutors. And the judge reprimanded him for having gone far afield of direct or circumstantial proof in opening remarks. Your opening statement handed out a promissory note that your case is not going to cash, the judge said. What did he say? Well, Lichtman told jurors that U.S. prosecutors had been dreaming for decades of convicting El Chapo, whose real name is Guzman, Joaquin Guzman, and the world is focusing on this mythical El Chapo figure. He said that his client is not the real leader of the cartel that sent tons of cocaine into the U.S. Instead, he wanted to shift the blame to Ismael El Mayo Zambada, another alleged drug trafficker in the cartel's leadership. He remains at large in Mexico, Lichtman claimed, because of bribes that go up to the very top, including hundreds of millions of dollars paid to the current and former presidents of Mexico. Now, that is quite an allegation. No evidence was offered to support that. But Lichtman went on to tell the jury, this is a case that will require you to throw out much of what you were taught to believe in about the way governments work and how they behave. Governments in South and Central America and Mexico and even the United States. This is a case which will require you to open your minds to the possibility that government officials at the very highest level can be bribed, can conspire to commit horrible crimes, that American law enforcement agents can also be crooked. So I think this is going to be a fascinating ride with a very interesting defense being offered, and we'll have to see where it all goes. Also on the crime beat, federal prosecutors have announced they are dropping their investigation into Jane Sanders, the wife of Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont. You may recall that she ran a college, Burlington College, that's in Burlington, Vermont, and she entered into a deal to purchase some land and relocate to a new campus of 32 acres, beautifully set along Lake Champlain, just north of Burlington. And the allegation is that she told college trustees and lenders that they had commitments for millions of dollars that didn't either exist or couldn't be proven. And ultimately, she resigned from the college, and the college had to shut down because they could not handle the financial commitments that Jane Sanders had made. I don't have any personal knowledge of what occurred there. I just have to say that Bernie did not handle this well, and that it did come up during the campaign, and he basically just ignored it, stonewalled the whole issue, and that does not, in my view, redound to his benefit. The battle over Trump's interim appointment of Matt Whitaker to be the acting attorney general has produced some legal documents. Over there at the Office of Legal Counsel at the Justice Department, a 20-page memo was issued by Stephen Engel, who is the head of OLC, and it comes a day after the state of Maryland and the city of San Francisco asked, or they raised questions, you know, about the legitimacy of this appointment, saying that as a matter of law, the succession should have led Rod Rosenstein to become the acting attorney general. So the OLC sidesteps questions about whether ethics rules required Whitaker to recuse himself from the Mueller investigation because he made such critical comments of it as a private citizen. And congressional Democrats have no response to a letter they sent to the ethics chief at the Justice Department asking if he had advised Whitaker to recuse himself. So today, several senators are trying to bring up the long-stalled bill that would allow special counsels like Mueller, if they get fired, to appeal their dismissal to a panel of judges. That one is dead on arrival, in my humble opinion. And Engel's memo also offered a vision of sweeping presidential power to basically do whatever he wants. So I do think that this is not constitutionally valid. I hope that the Democrats will fight it tooth and nail. They should be filing lawsuits about this every damn day, and if only to raise public awareness about how compromised Whitaker is. He himself is being investigated by the FBI over that patent marketing company that he was involved with in Florida. So this battle will continue. And my guess is that whatever dirty deeds Whitaker has been put up to will be completed before the end of the lame duck session, leaving Democrats able to investigate it, but not able to do anything to stop whatever actions Whitaker is planning to take. Every day I pause for a moment here to thank the people who support my work at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. And somebody took my cheat sheet that I keep right over here with the list of people who have recently made contributions through PayPal. You know who you are. Let me just summon them from the top of my head. Faith Peoples, Carl Howard, Mark Lewis. Oh, and there's good old Paul Elsesser, who I hope still has a home after the devastating fires in Northern California. I hope you'll join their ranks. Just come on over to peterbcollins.com. You click on menu, click on become a subscriber. You're on the sign-up page, and you choose $5, $10, $20 a month, the $50 annual subscription. That's how I fund this operation. And I don't make a much of a living doing it. I do other things to make a living. So I encourage you to support it. Maybe someday I'll be able to retire and just do this podcast. That's what I'd like. So the accounts of Trump's temper, his rage, and his tantrums, outbursts, just since he left for Europe last week, have really surfaced in a colorful and troubling way. On Air Force One, he took a call from British Prime Minister Theresa May, who may be on her way out. He questioned her over Brexit. He complained about trade deals. And his aides were shaken by his especially foul mood, we are told. And for Trump, that testy call set the tone for 5 days of fury, reports the Washington Post. Evident in his splenetic tweets. Oh, I guess that means they came from his spleen. And described in interviews with 14 senior administration officials, none of whom, of course, can be named because, well, because they're wusses, that's why. While he was in Paris for 43 hours, he brooded over the Florida recounts. He erupted at his staff over media coverage of his decision to skip that ceremony at the cemetery honoring American soldiers. He was angry and resentful over French President Macron's public rebuke of rising nationalism. He railed to aides that he's ready to shake up his administration, removing Homeland Security Secretary Nielsen and Chief of Staff John Kelly. And now we've got Melania, who is advocating for the sacking of the number two at the National Security Council. I'm sure he misses the mob rallies that allowed him to put down the remote, put down the Twitter, and go out there and fan the flames of racism and nationalism, hate and anger. And now all he can do is sulk in his own juices. On the flight back to Washington, aides filed into the president's private cabin on Air Force One to lobby against the leading contender to replace Kelly, Nick Ayers, who is Vice President Pence's chief of staff and is described as a polarizing figure. Amid reports that the president had decided to oust Deputy National Security Advisor Mira Ricardel, the First Lady's office issued a statement that it is the position of the office of the First Lady that Ricardel no longer deserves the honor of serving in this White House. Apparently, Melania got pissed off because Ricardel was made her minder on the trip to Africa. She jockeyed for space on the plane, and I don't know what else, and I don't care. And to have the First Lady weigh in on a personnel move like that, that's really rare. And then, of course, we reported yesterday about the ugly, insulting tweets that Trump leveled against the French people and the leader, Macron. And he did so in a way that is viewed in France as deeply insensitive, because his insults flew across the Twitter on a day when France was mourning the events of 2 years ago at the Bataclan, where 130 people were killed in that gruesome mass killing, mass shooting. And the only comment from the restrained French spokesperson, Trump is lacking common decency in his remarks and in their timing. Well, yesterday Amazon announced that they had successfully fleeced Long Island City in Queens and Crystal City in Northern Virginia. They're promising, well, they're dangling the promise of 25,000 jobs in each location. They've committed to a total of $5 billion in construction and other investments. They're also going to open a smaller site with 5,000 jobs in Nashville. And they succeeded in getting cities all across the country to compete in a race to the bottom. Who can bankrupt our city in order to dangle incentives in front of Jeff Bezos to get him to build a trickle-down investment in our community? And I want to credit Bryce Covert, a woman who is a contributor at The Nation, wrote a piece in the New York Times op-ed section yesterday saying, in the end, only Amazon and other corporations won this war. By pitting cities against each other, Amazon created a frenzy of ever more lavish and outlandish offers. Maryland bid $6.5 billion in tax incentives and another $2 billion in infrastructure upgrades. Its transportation secretary at one point offered a blank check. Newark, New Jersey, which is a city that, as far as I know, does not have an economic surplus to work with, dangled $7 billion in front of Amazon. Columbus, Ohio said it would waive all property taxes for 15 years. And she goes on to say the problem is that once a city offers a company a lucrative deal, other employers want the same. J.P. Morgan's chief executive, the bloodthirsty Jamie Dimon, said he would watch to see which city won the beauty contest and immediately call up those lawmakers and demand the same deal. And she writes, unfortunately, incentives and tax breaks don't work. Research indicates that there is not a large correlation between a state's giveaways and its unemployment rate or income levels. The typical package only changes a decision 25% of the time or less. About two-thirds of the incentives are handed to companies that would have moved to that location anyway. It is just disgusting. Texas schools have lost an estimated $4 billion to that state's economic development program. Cleveland schools lost over $30 million in 1 year alone. And this reminds me of the way Oakland was repeatedly screwed by the Oakland Raiders. They moved to L.A., and then inducements were created to get them to come back. And now they're packing up for Las Vegas. And between the Raiders and the Golden State Warriors, who are packing up and moving to San Francisco, Oakland is being left with a huge, huge gap. Bond money that they issued to pay to upgrade the stadium and arena in order to retain or win back these NFL franchises that gross millions. Win or lose, they're making money. And the big losers are the cities that they extort from. Well, this could be good news, but it also could lead to the collapse of the Netanyahu government in Israel. The hardline defense minister, Avigdor Lieberman, who is one of the most loathsome figures in the Zionist government, he quit after the government agreed to a ceasefire with Hamas to end 2 days of clashes in Gaza. Lieberman is withdrawing his party, which only has 6 seats in the Knesset, from the fragile coalition that keeps Netanyahu in power. And there is another minor political party that is run by Education Minister Naftali Bennett. That's called Jewish Home. They have a handful of seats, and they are prepared to pull out, which would cause the government to collapse. So it's a very tense situation for Netanyahu. Look for outrageous actions from him, including calls to attack Iran without any causes belli, just so he can try to preserve Israel. his tenuous hold on government in Israel. Likewise, Theresa May, holding an emergency cabinet meeting that went overtime today, her government could collapse as virtually all sides are angry over the draft Brexit agreement. Now, most of the government officials have not seen it. Some details have leaked, but there's only 5 months left until the exit takes place. Her primary challenge is to avoid a cabinet revolt. Even if the cabinet approves the draft, there are several steps before it could take effect. And the key sticking point remains the issues related to the Irish border. The Labour Party, under Jeremy Corbyn, is trading barbs with Theresa May. And the arch-conservatives, who, of course, want the hard Brexit, they are unhappy as well. I've been watching the recent report that came from the National Institutes of Health and its National Toxicology Program regarding the latest study exploring links between cancer and the exposure to wireless cell phone signals. The $30 million NTP studies demonstrated that cell phone radiation caused Schwann cell cancers of the heart and brain in rats, as well as DNA damage in the brain. The news release from the National Institutes of Health quoted senior scientist John Bucher, "We believe that the link between radio frequency radiation and tumors in male rats is real, and the external experts agreed. But amazingly, the FDA says that it disagrees with this carefully conducted, peer-reviewed study's finding." According to the FDA's director of Center for Devices and Radiological Health, Jeffrey Shuren, "These findings should not be applied to human cell phone usage. We believe the existing safety limits for cell phones remain acceptable for protecting the public health." Well, the op-ed here written by Ronald Melnick says that while expressing this opinion, Dr. Shuren neglects to note that the International Agency for Research on Cancer, a part of the World Health Organization, has classified radio frequency radiation from wireless devices as a possible human carcinogen. Thus, the same tumor types are elevated in both animals and humans exposed to cell phone radiation. Mr. Melnick continues here, "The FDA's position, the current FDA, is quite unusual because it was this agency that nominated cell phone radiation from devices to the NTP for toxicity and carcinogenicity studies in experimental animals to provide the basis to assess the risk to human health." So I know it's controversial, but I do think that we have concerns here that we should pay attention to. Now we go into the post-election contests in Florida and Georgia for today's update. One of the issues is that there are multiple close elections in Florida, including one guy who's running for the Florida legislature, and he lost by 37 votes. Now, he's entitled to a recount, but because of the statutory deadline of this Thursday, there isn't time to do the Senate recount, the governor's race recount, the agricultural commissioner recount. Those are all statewide races, and this one itty-bitty district race. And so this has led to a court in Leon County, which took up the case from Palm Beach County because of recusals. And they have ordered that there should be more time to count the votes, at least in that county. If you allow one county more time, shouldn't you allow all counties more time? Of course, the Republicans are racing to shut down the vote counting as early as possible because they have leads that they are trying to protect. We also know that the tabulation machines that have been used for the recount have jammed. They had to fly in mechanics to address it. And so there are a series of problems related to this recount. And it appears at this stage that tomorrow the Republicans who run Florida will brazenly push to certify the results when it's clear that not all votes have been counted once, and that many votes will not have been counted a second time, even if they were counted once. And you get great coverage over at Brad Blog. I recommend the work of my friend Brad Friedman. He interviewed Ion Sancho, who I've talked to many times before. He is retired as the Leon County, that's Tallahassee, Supervisor of Elections. And he said, look, it is likely impossible to meet the state's ridiculously arbitrary statutory deadlines. He says that the state puts a premium on speed over accuracy. This is by no means a system geared toward finding the truth. Sancho details how even in a manual count in Florida, ballots are first fed through tabulation computers, and only ballots determined by the computers to be overvotes or undervotes are then reexamined. But even those ballots are, yes, remade by officials into a fresh paper ballot so that it can be then run through a computer tabulator. So, also in Florida, Who What Why reports that our friend John Brakey from Arizona was able to sneak in just as the polls were closing and captured a cell phone video of a voting machine, a scanner, a digital voting scanner, that was sending results to the county center via a wireless transmission. This has been a vulnerability they've been talking about, the election integrity advocates, and it means that there is no secure chain of custody for election materials in Broward County or any other county that has modems inside their election systems. So this is another serious issue that will not be addressed now. The election will be faulty because of it. And you can expect that in the months and years ahead, nothing will be done about it. Carol Anderson, the professor from a university in Georgia, has written another great piece entitled Why Is No One Talking About the Uncounted Suppressed Votes in Florida? She is referring to how a ballot measure restored voting rights to former felons, but Rick Scott made sure that that didn't occur in time for this election. I recommend the professor's book. It's One Person, No Vote, How Voter Suppression is Destroying Our Democracy, and it's a very well-written book that has great details about the history of Jim Crow in this country. I'm out of time to comment on this in detail, but I've linked to a commentary by Ben Max at BuzzFeed. He sums it up in the headline, Voting is Broken by Design. Yes, the system works for the people who are already elected, and that's why they don't care much about trying to fix it. A Georgia state senator who joined a group of protesters who were there related to the election, the election fraud. Yes, that's what it is in Georgia. She was inside the rotunda of the Capitol or the legislature there in Atlanta. And she said, look, I was not yelling. I was not chanting. I stood peacefully next to my constituents, and now I'm being arrested. And she said she was being singled out because she is black. Her name is Senator Nikema Williams, a Democrat from Atlanta. And she said, I was singled out as a black female standing in the rotunda with constituents in the Capitol, a body that I serve in. I was singled out and arrested today for standing with so many Georgians who are demanding that every vote be counted. Justice was not upheld yesterday, she said. I didn't put on my to-do list to get arrested. I did not plan to go to the Fulton County Jail and take off my clothes and get strip searched. And Greg Palast reports that some of those arrests followed the display of inflatable numeric balloons that spelled out the number 340,134, the number of voters who Brian Kemp purged from participation in this very close election for governor of the great state of Georgia. That's our news and comment podcast for today. You're free to share it far and wide. I certainly hope you will. You'll find it on YouTube for your listening convenience. And I'm still Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.